John Rivett with Dave Murley. Is that how you pronounce it?
Yes.
What kind of name is Murley?
English.
Okay. Who is a fellow Mac person, so I know him through the Mac, but I think we may have met when he was president or something of the Michigan Political History Association. Does that sound right?
Yeah, Political History Society.
You Thanks.
Showed up at one of our meetings. Well, I'm sure you went to several, but I remember one of our board meetings at the Medical Society, and you were the guy who had done video histories before and had suggestions to the group.
Oh, okay. At that time, I was on the Historical Society of Michigan's board.
I remember reading it in the Michigan Historical Review.
Okay, and we were meeting there.
Oh, okay.
The Historical Society of Michigan had been in Ann Arbor, and then it moved to an office there.
Mm-hmm.
I think it probably was the same. What's that guy who died?
Kevin Kelly.
Kevin Kelly, and I think he probably played a role in both groups getting to meet there because he was a big Michigan history guy.
Yes, yes. And very, very amazing guy and very very good guy, very promoted history, and I think for its own sake and for the fact that it was something that people from all political parties, members of all political parties at least, have that in common.
Did he help create the Michigan Political History Association?
Yes.
Society?
He was. He was probably the lead in it.
Okay. What did he die of? Cancer? I remember reading about, but I can't. It was a few years ago now.
I don't know for certain what it was. But
he was a young man, though.
He was young. He had had health problems through the years. As a matter of fact, I can't tell you, but I know he had issues, health issues.
It's what we were going to talk about, but I just remember when that was.
And I'm going to guess he died in maybe 2007, 2008.
And so we must have met a few years before then.
Yeah, well, I remember Lash LaRue was still alive because I asked him about you.
Oh.
Like, just because I knew you were in the labor school.
Uh-huh.
And,
see, isn't it good it didn't matter that we had quiet? This guy's got a job to do. And this one. So we were going to talk about Lash, and I wanted, you had various things about Lash to tell me. And as I said, this doesn't have to be one-shot thing. So I brought some Lash stuff.
Such okay. As,
you autographed one of his books to me.
Oh, excellent.
And that looks like it says April 89.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what year he died, actually.
But he died in...
I've got visuals. I don't remember.
2006.
And I just throw stuff in this. So. So what was your relationship to Lash LaRue?
Well, I started off as his teaching assistant.
And how did you get that job?
Well, MSU had a well-regarded economics department, and I was an economics major. But it was the number of economics courses they had to offer, and the enrollment in the classes was quite large. You know, to get a degree in business, you know, you had to take a bunch of econ classes. You know, all kinds of other majors required at least the intro economics classes, and often additional classes. You know, some required, I think it was labor three or economics 305 on labor economics, and you know, all these
is
other
that
things.
The one in the Kiva?
It was, at least some of those classes were taught in the Kiva. I know Lash taught 305 in the Kiva at least some of the years.
Because that was part of what my interaction with him was. He would have me come in once a year and give a guest lecture.
Okay.
Maybe on Michigan labor history or something.
That was almost certainly it.
And it was at the Erickson Kiva.
Yep, he taught that class many years at the Kiva.
Uh-huh.
So long and short of it is, they needed, yet there was only a handful of econ majors. There was maybe only 120 econ majors for a faculty that, you know, who knows how big it is, but let's say it's 40 or 45 professors. So, and their graduate program was not enormous, so a lot of the, so they needed teaching assistants, you know, just to grade the papers or whatever else. And so they had to dig down, and you know, they actually offered some undergraduates teaching assistant jobs.
What were you at that time?
A junior.
So, so you were an undergrad?
Yes.
Okay.
So I was an undergraduate, and so they offered me a TA position, and I...
As an undergrad?
Yeah, as an undergrad.
Which was rare, right?
Yes, and
I think... it'd be grad students, PhD candidates.
Exactly, but I think, again, just because of the... because they needed... they needed the people, you know, to do it. And, you know, it was, I don't know what they made. It was probably, it was the equivalent of a year's tuition. It was probably $3,000 back then. So, okay. Hey, that's great.
Took what almost, year was back then? What year are we talking?
Well, this would have been 1988.
Okay. So the fall of 88, maybe.
Yes. So I was assigned to, you know, I got a letter saying, your guy you're assigned to is Lash LaRue. And,
you had nothing to do with the choice.
No. And I thought, you've got to be kidding me. At the time, I'm the president of the College Republicans. And all I knew about this LaRue guy is he was a leftist, you know, and you know, would make these crazy statements, and had been an anti-Vietnam guy, an all-around rabble-rouser, had run for Congress and sued the university on retirement and all these other things. And I figured, how did I get paired with him? I hope that's going to go over okay. You know, I don't know if our politics will clash. But they didn't. I found him to be a very... delightful guy. We became close friends, and he then served as a graduate advisor on my master's and doctoral papers, and we took several day trips together around the state in his Rolls Royce, and would go up north on occasion.
You would go with him?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, we'd go together. We'd go, hey, let's go up north and stay in Boyne City, or you know, take his roles to... maybe it was just a day going to Hell, Michigan.
You never did a Frisco trip with him?
No. Nope.
It was great to see him drive around town, and everybody sort of knew...
that's right.
...about and Lash.
He had two of them. The first one he had, he went out west. No, he went to took it to Alaska with a guy he went to college with. And he said he then recalled earlier in the trip why he didn't like the guy back in the 30s. And,
okay.
And now was regretting
going with him.
And so at various points they would take turns driving. And he let the other guy drive.
He let the other guy drive his vehicle?
Yes, and he
wow.
And he crashed it, and that was the end of his Rolls. That Rolls Royce. So then he got a...
that was before your time. He was telling you that story?
No. This occurred in 1992.
Oh, okay. So just for the record, you're his undergrad TA when you were a junior and a senior?
But just a junior.
Okay.
That was only a one-year deal, I'm not
two
sure.
Two semesters, then, okay.
Or at the time, three quarters.
Of course, right.
And so then, but, you know, stayed close with him. I graduated in 1990. That year I was a TA for him was his last year on the faculty.
Okay.
And how did it work? He taught... so I was his TA for two semesters, and then I want to say... the third semester, he was, they asked him to be FGO to fill in, I think. There was an opening, a vacancy. So,
did you know that this was his second time as FGO?
Yes.
You did know that.
I
he told
that.
You, I already did this job, and now I'm going to come back to fill in.
Yes. So, in the... 1988, he was in Marshall Hall.
Which is where the FGO office was.
Oh, it was.
Before it went to the auditorium, I believe.
All right.
I didn't bring those notes with me, but I have them.
Then in the second semester, he was in the auditorium. But he still taught at least one
Marshall is
class.
Where his econ office
yes.
was. I'm sorry. Okay.
And then the third semester, for whatever reason, I think the third semester he didn't teach Econ 305. He taught another course, so I was assigned to another professor.
What was Econ 305 again called at the
Labor time? Economics.
Labor economics. And that Lash taught that with, I wouldn't have been the only session they had that had labor history.
Okay.
I would assume. Did you ever sit in on his class?
On occasion.
What did you think did he cover? I mean, did he do macro, micro, or did he do...
His labor econ class was much more history than other professors.
That's what I was getting at.
You're right. I mean, and he spoke a lot about Harry Bridges. As a matter of fact, his Harry Bridges book was assigned to the class.
And that's a... I don't know what you think about it. I think it's a pretty good labor history. I
mean, it's
nice narrative, easy to read. I would assume students didn't mind reading it.
They
might have wondered, why are we reading this book in an econ class?
Right.
But.
Well, and that, you know, Lash was less of a, I think, if you were to talk to young guys on the faculty at the time, they would think of Lash as a dinosaur.
Uh-huh.
That their world is all econometrics and really you're almost a math major before, math, you're almost getting a doctorate in mathematics.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's the nature of, and from what I understand, poli sci is the same way today. But if you were to look at the leading economics journals, they'd be...
numbers.
Yeah. I mean,
charts and numbers.
Whereas that wasn't, I'm sure he had to take some of that stuff when he was... in grad school, but that was certainly not his cup of tea.
Did he ever teach that sort of thing? I don't remember.
No. It wouldn't have made any sense to him. You know, he was more of a history guy.
Institutional economics person from the 30s. I mean, really, in some ways, to
me. Right. The labor movement.
Mm-hmm. Now, were you ever offended as a college Republican president, whatever, that what he was saying was...
No.
Offensive to you or unfair or...
No. What I found was he often would... He had a, by his own admission, a knee-jerk reaction on certain things. He couldn't help himself. He always had a kind of...
Bias?
Left, what I would call leftist or liberal or some might call it compassionate or whatever else view on things. And it was his starting point on just about everything. But then by his own admission, he'd say, can you believe that's what I was for? I mean, look, they listened to us and look how screwed up it got, something like the school busing, with the...
Oh, in Pontiac at the time?
Pontiac or Detroit, where they would ship, the city kids in the suburbs or the suburban kids into the city, or at least that was the plan. He said, I was all for that. I figured that would help build better race relations, and that would build up the Detroit schools because if the suburban kids had to go there. But he said, I think that type of thing had negative effects.
Mm-hmm.
So almost whatever it was, he'd
be willing to rethink the thing.
Well, yeah, I mean, he'd admit he didn't take himself seriously. I mean, he had thought through it, and he would say, "Look, I'm for the underdog, or I come to things with a certain perspective, but a lot of what I've advocated has led to problems or." It may have started off as a good idea or a good cause, but then degenerated into something else.
So, this book he autographed for me is Lashing Out, Best of Lash, which was columns like this 1977 Meanest Speaker. that, I mean, just tick people off, these kind of things?
Well, you know, by the time I was around, that was in maybe the last couple years of his column, and I don't know that I never knew anyone who read it or discussed it.
So students in the Republican Club didn't.
Well, or even I was in Case Hall. I just don't remember it being.
Okay, because it was Friday column, I think.
Yeah. Now, probably in the 1970s, it was more
provocative.
More provocative, or more had more interest to the students, but I just don't remember it being.
Do you recall the tanning butter contest?
I do. the cocoa butter contest or something like that.
Yeah,
yes.
Exactly.
That was him. I mean, you know, if you read through that, he has, you know, there
this is lashing out the best to lash.
Yeah, I mean, it's some of his, you know.
Column.
There I am checking out the co-eds, you know, he said, you know, to show you the different tenor of the times, he's in, you know, so there I am doing some lines, you know, and like making reference to marijuana or cocaine, which I guess, you know, we back in the 70s, they viewed differently than they view today.
Right. Which I don't know that he would ever do, actually.
No, not the cocaine. He think he may have indulged in some of the
alcohol.
Oh, well, he liked his whiskey, and
right.
I think don't think he minded sampling a little
smoke.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
From before I, you know, in the 60s.
Yeah, exactly.
To me, I mean, his wit. Was best demonstrated by this
appendix.
So LaRue likes his book. This has got to be the best book I've ever read. A thing of passing grace and power, it is a well-proportioned biography that grasps the reader in its early chapters and lifts him effortlessly into the vital past. You know, a tour de force of wit and intellect, or, you know, he has all these. This reviewer, for one, would not hesitate for a moment to nominate this excellent book for a Pulitzer Prize.
And, who wrote that?
Right, LaRue reviewing his own book, which to me is hilarious. I mean, it's, and he said, people, you know, I read this review of the book, and I got the book, and I just didn't think it was that good. You know, I guess he didn't realize that not everyone would put two and two together. That he was.
No, I think he was smart enough that he knew that some fools out there didn't get it. And, you know, when he autographed the book to me, it was like, a fellow laborer in the Vineyard of Academy and a member of the small band of folks who appreciate my weird sense of humor. Lash himself.
Right. Well, he's a good guy.
He was.
A very good guy. I would often go over there, and I'd bring a six-pack, he'd open up the whiskey, and we'd cook steaks.
Yeah,
and
in the side.
In his little kitchen there.
Yeah, yeah.
And
it was small.
Steaks and potatoes, and, you know, and then just...
So how long did you stay friends with him?
Till he died.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how, did you have a regular visit, or just when you were...
I was... You know, probably was over there. I dealt with him came over about once a month.
Okay. What did the Republican Club do, by the way, in those years? Or whatever, I'm sorry.
Yeah, yeah.
It was called the MSU Republican?
Yeah. We did stuff on the... We brought the Nicaraguan Contras in one time and stuff. It was shortly before the 88 election, so stuff relating to the presidential election. And
okay.
Just
to digress, at the time, would you still use the term Millikan Republicans to talk about moderate Republicans, or not even use that term, or how did you see yourself? I mean, this is long before things like Tea Party and...
Certainly the term Millikan Republican, I don't think was ever used by our group. It...
Because he was too close. I mean, he'd just been...
Well, you're right. So that I would have been... 5-6 years after he left office, and I think most of the people in that group were kind of focused on the national issues, so it was more, you know, do you support Dole, Bush, or Kemp, or, you know, possibly Pat Robertson for if someone wanted to. So it was all varying degrees of conservative.
Now, at this time, almost everybody, whether Dem or Republican, MSU undergrads, and a Michigan student, they're coming from a Michigan family, right? Yeah. I assume this is James Madison we're talking about.
Well, I was in Case Hall. I was not actually a Madison student, though. I knew those guys. What was the percentage? It was probably 10 to 15% out of state.
Yeah, I would think that's only partly because of Madison. I think if you moved out of Madison, the percent's even lower for out of state in those years. It was really small.
Yeah, you know,
it doesn't matter. Yeah. But. What I was kind of curious of is Lash would have known these, where the students were coming from, that they were Michigan kids. And how did he relate to kids that, like yourself, were more maybe coming from parents who were very Republican or they were rural kids or whatever versus his kids that might be more city-oriented, Democratic-oriented?
Well, no, he taught, I thought he treated everyone with respect, or I've never.
But you wouldn't have hung out with him for that many years.
I heard two kind of negative things about him, or things where he may have gotten caught up in the moment, and probably would have admitted what I was doing interfered with something I shouldn't have interfered with. One was, they disrupted some type of ROTC graduation ceremony.
A politically left group of student group did that?
Yes. Okay. And he was involved.
Oh.
And he regrets doing that. Or he said he regretted doing that. It was their graduation. The parents had come in. This kid's going to be off to Vietnam or wherever. And, you know, and here they are doing a...
This is before your time, but he told me about it.
Yeah, yeah. And then something someone told me that Lash was part of is at some point in the 1970s, early 1970s, they had taken over Berkey Hall and they had blocked the classroom.
Student demonstrators.
Yes, had blocked
entrance. Anti-war demonstrators,
yes.
Probably. Okay.
And that I think Lash had locked arms with other people and you know, you couldn't get into a classroom, whereas I think he never talked about that, but the student said I was offended because I had paid money to go to class and now I was being stopped from going to class. What's up with that? And and so while Lash was never personal with these things, right, I don't think denounced anyone as you this or that, if you were to bring these things up, you'd say, yeah, you know, that's right. Why did I do that? I wasn't thinking about
their point,
I think sometimes these guys get on such a theoretical, you know, the justice of our cause is so important.
Yeah.
We must do A, B, and C.
Yeah.
And so on, but he certainly didn't engage in violence or anything like that. And when I went through the archives, some of Hannah's papers, I mean, there were things by Lash in the early 60s.
Why were you going through archives?
Well, I wrote a master's paper on John Hanna and the Red Scare. And so I went through...
Oh, I would like to look at that.
It's a tour de force of wit and intellect. It deserves a Pulitzer Prize. I'm not quoting from...
No, I understand. Where would I find it? Do you still have a copy?
I don't. I mean, it's somewhere on the library shelves.
Okay. This was a master's in econ?
No, I got my master's and doctorate in history.
Oh, okay.
And so for my master's, I wrote... John Hanna and the Red Scare. And so Lash was a valuable source for that. But in going through the papers, I came across a letter from Lash at some point in the 60s, or maybe 1964, to Hannah saying, you know, we were outside of Kresge's demonstrating, and there were some state MSU police taking everyone's picture. And, you know, this is violating our rights. And, you know, they were sharing them with the police and the FBI and things like that. So, you know, obviously he was concerned about people's civil liberties and you know, was just suspicious of government and people in authority. And I understand why. That was just his inclination. So,
if your master's thesis in history was for what prof?
A guy named David Bailey.
Okay.
History department. And
still
then
around.
Lash. Yep, Lash was on the, I worked on it more with Lash than I did Bailey.
And, okay, that was Hannah and the Red Scare.
Yes.
Okay, of the late 50s.
It looked 46 to 54.
Okay. Well, that had no references to labor programs of any sort, did it? Not that you recall.
Not that I recall.
Okay. 53 is the earliest I found that MSU was doing any labor education extension. The school, the Labor Industrial Relations Center is until a little later, so that would not include it. Then what did you do your PhD in?
The Supreme Court and the Red Scare.
The Michigan Supreme Court?
No, the U.S. Supreme
Court. U.S. Supreme Court. And who was that done under whose direction?
Bailey, Lash, and a guy named Morgan Sweeney, who's no longer with us.
Okay, I've heard the name, but I have no idea of the person. So Bailey's still around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's hard to get a hold of, but he's...
Yeah, I didn't realize he'd been moved back that... Okay. Oh, of course. Okay.
He probably started at MSU in 1980 or 81.
And what was he... What classes of... Did you serve then as a grad assistant for him or anybody?
No. After I graduated, I did a very short stint in the military. I got hurt.
Right.
So I figured, well, you know... Maybe this academic thing's for me. So I got my master's and then said, no, it isn't for me. I went off to law school. And then when I was... So I came back here.
Did you go to law school?
I did.
At Michigan?
Yeah, at Georgetown. So I...
Did you get that degree, too?
Oh, yeah.
I didn't realize you had that degree also.
So I was...
You got a lot of degrees.
More degrees in good sense. So I came back here and then thought, look, if I'm, I find the archives and history and all this stuff interesting, why not, as kind of a hobby, get my PhD?
Uh-huh.
I'll work full time, but then...
Who were you working for?
At the time, Governor Engler. I started, and then Candace Miller.
As a personal assistant or as...
As an attorney.
Okay. In a general... operation, or did you do certain kinds of law?
Certain kinds of law.
Okay.
But, you know, because I already had the master's, I didn't have to take a ton of classes.
Okay.
So then I just did my comprehensive exams, and then just banged out my PhD on my own time, so.
Cool. While you were full-time working for the governor?
Let's see, at that time, yes,
wow.
Between the Secretary of State and the House of Representatives, I've had many jobs in my tenure. So I go to the Library of Congress or University of Texas or University of Kentucky to go through various justices' papers. And so Lash was on my committee, and I'd always I'd have him go through my stuff and make sure it read well.
Mm-hmm. He's a good writer.
Very good writer.
Yeah.
What I know about him, and the other thing I guess to keep in mind is about him, even though, you know, he was known for his opposition to the Vietnam War and in general was against American military intervention of any kind, you know, he did win a Silver Star on Okinawa. was actually a some type of, not a conscientious objector, but well, he was anti-war and didn't think we should be involved in the war. He worked as a British ambulance driver.
You're talking World War II.
In World War II.
Yeah.
And then once America entered the war, left, volunteered for the American Army. Mm-hmm. And so whatever his, I guess he had a certain amount of credibility when it came to anti-war things.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think he took lightly to people. It's not that they, he fully understood people disagreeing with him.
Mm-hmm.
But when they'd say things like, you know, let's bomb Libya and bomb the civilians or whatever, and he'd say, no, you can't bomb civilians. That's, and they'd say, well, war is hell. And he'd say, listen, USOB, what do you know about war?
Yeah.
You know, and so...
He knew.
Yeah, I mean, that, and that, I guess, was always, and gave him a certain amount of credibility. But if you wanted to denounce him as a pacifist or whatever else, fact is, he operated a flamethrower on Okinawa and took a bullet in the shoulder. So,
were a lot of the kids who were in the Republican Club, either when you were there or later that you had any interaction with, tended to be military sons or daughters?
No.
Okay. I'm just curious.
Nope. But I know, so when Lash, so he came here in 56,
mm-hmm.
he had his joint appointment between econ and labor.
Right.
And I don't know at what stage he went full-time econ.
I interviewed him a long time ago, and I didn't find my notes before this. Maybe if we meet again, I'll find my notes and go listen to the tape. So I don't recall. I know in general, many people, when I tell them that the original Labor Industrial Relations Center under a guy named Charles Killingsworth, and then Jack Stieber was hired to be the research director, and then they had two outreaches, labor and management. Many people were surprised when I tell them that the very first years, and I don't remember how many, all these people had joint appointments.
Mm-hmm.
So there was Lash LaRue with joint appointment, the LIR Center and economics. Walter Adams had the same kind of arrangement. I think actually Killingsworth and Stieber was the same arrangement. I don't know what other ones you had any heard about through him.
Oh, well, Killingsworth, I know. I mean, he had a great reputation. I mean,
as an economist.
Yeah.
Again, a very much a kind of an institutionalist, 1930s, 40s.
And I mean, I know he would
Keynesian, I assume, kind of.
And I think he would do labor mediations and things like that for prominent, I mean, not just local things. I mean,
national stories. Yeah. So you heard about that through Lash, that he would tell you about Killingsworth, or did you actually meet him in his senior years? I can't remember the year he dies, but
I never met him.
Okay.
I can't remember if he was involved in that MSU Vietnam project or not, but there was something very unfortunate that happened to him. I want to say he may have suffered a closed head brain injury or something that and with all, you know, it's just a factor of...
I interviewed Killingsworth, but only about the history of the school, the beginning, and I don't remember talking to him about other things other and
something unfortunate happened with Killingsworth, and I can't remember what that was. I remember one of the guys, was it Wes Fischel?
Uh-huh.
One of the guys involved in the Vietnam
mm-hmm.
project.
Right.
You know, they'd have all his demonstrations in his class, and eventually he left here and went mm-hmm. somewhere else just because it drove him away. Russ and I interviewed him about the Red Scare, and he, too, whenever he mentioned Lash, you know, we won a Silver Star, but he had been fallen by a stroke.
Now, you interviewed people like Russell and I, what had happened to that interview tape? Is that here at the MSU Voice Library?
No, I just took notes. That was...
Okay, you didn't do anything on...
No.
...on tape recorder like this?
Nope.
What'd you do with your notes?
Probably long since...
Throw them away?
Yeah. You know, okay. And whatever they told me of note ended up in...
In the book.
In the... Right. My master's paper. Yep.
That didn't ever become a book, but...
No.
And what was your PhD then?
The U.S. Supreme Court and the Red Scare.
And did it still have a Michigan focus to it?
Nope.
Or not at all?
Not at all.
Okay. Okay. But so it was about civil liberties, rights of people, and debates about civil rights? Or what was the...
No, it was the Red Scare, the whole McCarthy era.
Right, right. I didn't mean civil rights in Maine at black-white relations. I meant in terms of people's civil libertarian rights.
Well, or mostly... Not necessarily. I mean, there's some of that, but there, like the issue of what are your speech rights on the street and things like that. Supreme Court was also considering those issues, but that was a little bit different than what I looked at. It was mostly how the court handled. The House Un-American Activities Committee prosecutions and the, you know, the labor union, you know, the anti-communist affidavit.
So you did look at a little bit of the labor stuff in terms of the communist affidavits of the CIO?
Yes. I mean, to whatever extent, the labor actually, they at least play a role in, you know, they play a role in probably a third of the cases I looked at. There was often, maybe the union was trying to expel a guy, maybe the guy was part of a union expelled from the CIO because, you know, the certain unions were expelled, as you're aware. Maybe it may have been a person who gave a false name in order to get in the union.
Mm-hmm.
To help organize, or not union, to get hired by the company to then help organize various. So unions appear are a big part of the story, of course, with the whole Red Scare.
Did you want to stop for a second, get something to eat?
Well, let me put some cash in the meter, and I will get a Phillips. And that's where Steve Esquist's thing is, right?
Yeah, you know Steve?
Yeah, just from the Mac, and then I knew him. I remembered him from Case Hall.
Why from Case Hall? Oh,
because he was a Madison professor before he was a philosophy professor.
So, and I forget that part.
Yeah, he's. I assume since Madison, there's very, at least it was the case, there wasn't the same emphasis on publishing. I think he wanted to do a little bit more in the publishing area and move it over to philosophy.
Yeah, I was going to say he went to philosophy, but see, just what I was...
Oh, yeah. All right.
I worked for them for a couple of years.
Okay.
And actually, it's emeritus. I'm doing stuff again with them.
Oh, great.
So I ate meals at Snyder and did a freshman 15 every semester the first 2 years.
I believe it. The well, one thing, and I know I made a reference to it, is for purposes of your history of the labor school, there's something in the Hanna Papers, a Russell Kirk column in National Review, where Kirk couldn't stand John Hanna, even though both were, might call themselves, well, Hanna was a Republican. I don't know that Russell Kirk, he would call himself a conservative, certainly, whether he would call himself a Republican, I don't know. But he wrote a column called, I think, From the Academy, or there was something in National Review, and he would often attack John Hanna and MSU because Kirk had gone here as a student.
Similar time as Hanna?
Well, let's see. Kirk would have probably been here in the 30s.
Hanna wasn't it?
Hanna may have been, I want to say Hanna was born in 1903. So whenever that would have been, in the probably in the 20s. Maybe, so but maybe I could have my dates. I could have my dates off. But
no, I think you're right.
And then Kirk was a professor here for a couple years when Hanna was president. And I think he saw MSU becoming this behemoth university, but sacrificing its educational standards to do it. You know, that.
What was Kirk teaching when he was here?
Philosophy. I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right.
It could have been English.
Yeah, I was going to say that was the other thing I was thinking.
And so he, you know, I think with this basic college that they had in place, and, you know, I think he just saw these mass classes and mass, thank you, that getting away from the idea of what an education was supposed to be. And so he always was anti, he became a very strong opponent of John Hanna, and used his column.
About the expansion, the World War II, post-World War II
expansion
exactly. of the place.
Diluting standards, too much emphasis on football. the, you know, he had one ripping on Hanna for, like, I think it was either because we had a school of packaging or more likely, I'm almost sure he wrote a full column on MSU had some type of mobile home management. Or something like it was some program that was funded by the industry that, you know, Russell Kirk said, you've got to be kidding.
What is this doing? Academics.
Right. And that goes to the larger question of what, you know, MSU does have a lot of those types of programs that are where people get jobs. I mean, you certainly can't knock them on that front, but they're not the traditional, you know, academic
right. No, this was applied, and it's the land grant philosophy that Hanna really took in a direction much more boldly than some others places. He really took advantage of the GI Bill of Rights and expanded this place from, you know, a modest amount. Yeah, I think it doubles. I don't know, 8,000 to 20,000 or something.
Yeah,
in the Hanna years.
Oh yeah. But
anyways, the Labor Industrial Relations Center is part of that story.
There was one. He wrote a column about a guy who, he said that Hanna was discriminating against because he was a conservative, and that he would deliberately schedule his classes such that this guy couldn't do other types of work. You know, he had some type of consulting deal, and he'd say that they would schedule his classes on Tuesday and a Friday, and so that, you know, he couldn't, and then maybe a Monday and a Wednesday, so he could never get away, and he, you know, that this was all because he was a Republican or a conservative or the labor movement didn't like him.
And he's blaming Hanna for this rather
yes.
than the... Now, is this the fella in the Labor Industrial Relations Center?
It's a guy who somehow was working in LIR.
Wasn't he in charge of the management outreach?
That may have been it. I can't. I don't know.
You know, this is reading this article when you're researching.
Yeah. I read this 20 years ago, and then I talked to Lash about it. So, oh yeah, I remember that guy. He had no. I mean, they try to make this big political thing, but the fact is, he wanted to make his money doing his consulting thing. And, you know, he got assigned whatever classes, whatever hours, and, you know, one semester would be this, and he said that's how it is. You get assigned this class or that class and these hours. And so it wasn't MSU
going out of their way to make it impossible for the guy to do his other job. It was figure out how you do this side thing outside of what you are, have been assigned as a member of the faculty. And he said it became a political issue. And at some point, I want to say, didn't remember last thing that the LIR budget changed. It went from a line item to, or excuse me, was it... It either went from a line item to rolled into the general appropriation or vice versa.
So I haven't at this point shared with you my manuscript on this story, correct?
Mm-hmm. Mm-mm.
Right. Well, after this, okay? We can chat another time about it. Did you hear about a state Senate investigation at all in that discussion?
Yes.
Okay, what do you recall of that?
I remember Lash telling me that the legislature looked into this, and it because I can't remember if it was I can't remember much, just that it became a political issue downtown, and this was part of the Russell Kirk column,
and this event is 60 and 61.
Okay.
And Lash is telling you this around 1991.
Yes.
30 years later, he's telling his research assistant, now friend, who's a Republican, working for the Republican governor.
Right. Not, I would a little bit later, but and then I was still in grad school.
Okay.
But yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so that, exactly, because I brought him a copy. I photocopied that column from the Hanna papers and said, who's this guy and what happened here? And so... Lash said, yeah, this guy brought LIR into hot water and tried to tangle up Hanna in it, and he said the guy didn't have a leg to stand on. There wasn't discrimination, or maybe it was a labor versus management thing, or maybe it was Republican versus Democrat.
Who didn't have a leg to stand on?
The guy complaining.
Okay. Anything else about that that I should ask you?
Again, not that I recall.
Okay, I wouldn't think so, but I mean, that's a 30-year-old story when you're told. Or something.
Right. Well, and I just wanted to make sure you knew there was something in the Hanna papers or about this guy, and so it sounds like you've already or you may know something about it. Good.
Yeah, and I'll share that with you, but I didn't want to before this.
Good.
In the. Mid-90s, we had the anniversary of the school. So if the school is 56, that would be 96, some anniversary. And I did some research looking at different papers, Stever's Killingsworth, Hanna papers, as well as interviewing Lash and Repus. We haven't talked about yet, but we can come back to them. Killingsworth, Stever, Adams, who else? Whatever. Oh, Bill Fonts. I don't know if you ever ran across that name. He was in sociology.
Okay.
He was one of these joint things, one of the few that wasn't econ. Anyway, so I interviewed a lot of those folks and did this. Never published it, but I'm still working on it, but I will get it published now. But, it was the story of how the LIR Center goes from a center to being a school of labor industrial relations.
Okay.
And part of it is in response to the state Senate investigation. And the fellow that you're talking about, I'm sure, the same story.
Yeah, and what was his name?
I didn't prepare.
Right, no, I did.
I didn't even read that paper. I didn't bring it along because I didn't even know we were going to come up with him. I knew we were doing Lash stories, and I forgot that you said you had something to tell me about it. It'll come to me. But anyways, he was at the school's beginning. It's a labor industrial relations center. It's reporting to three deans. It's not just College of Social Science at all yet. That would fit kind of with your story about line item business, things changing. It was more directly relating to the president. It was clearly created because labor was influential in the state of Michigan.
Yep.
I've told people in class, 1960, 49% of the Michigan workforce belongs to a union officially. And at that point, public sector aren't unionized. So it's a really different world.
Well,
So the labor went to the state legislature and went to the three universities and said, you ought to do stuff for us.
Well, and if you think about it, it's completely consistent with the John Hanna approach to building the university, right? I mean, a school of packaging. There's a bunch of people with a bunch of money who will put up cash for this, that, and the other thing, and our guys come, you know, they come out and they all have jobs. Like I said, this mobile homes management or whatever it was. I can't remember exactly what that, but the building construction management, you know, these so not only does he add things where there's a demand or a supply. In other words, if someone's willing to ante up the dough, you know, come talk to us. Likewise, you know, what are some of these things where we can actually get people placed? Certainly the labor school, I mean, he was a very politically shrewd guy and could see the writing on the wall and the way things were moving. And, you know, the board would be dominated by the Democratic Party / labor for years to come. And he, I assume, probably got along well with Gus Scholl, or at least made his peace with the guy. And, you know, they... you know, as I see it, this was MSU's chance to not be cut out of the picture. I mean, if you hey, even look at our international programs, look at the Vietnam program, look at things like that, where again, there's Hanna realizing an opportunity. Not that some of it doesn't backfire, there's not negatives, but it was, hey, the federal government wants colleges to help set up the South Vietnamese government by providing agriculture and administrative services and this, that, and the other thing, and they're paying these exorbitant sums, you know, at a time where endowment was essentially, if not a dirty word, almost unheard of a way from a land-grant college. It was like, look at this great source of cash. So, when you mentioned the labor school and the labor and Hanna seeing an opportunity, and not looking at it through an ideological lens, but from a purely practical lens, it, you know, it makes sense.
I don't remember which book it is, but and again, I didn't. I brought a bunch of things to for show and tell, but I didn't bring that. One of the books on the history of MSU, an older one, not the recent series, focused in on LAR and packaging and about a half dozen or a dozen units that in the 50s and the 60s were this kind of land-grant mission writ in a new, wider way than had been done before. And it's just little 4 or 5 page stories on each of these units. And it's, you know, it's exactly what you're getting at. Before I forget, back to your PhD, whichever it was, master's or PhD. Did you do anything on either Michigan stories related to Red Scare at University of Michigan and faculty, or the one at Olivet? You know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. I think I certainly make reference to them in it, but I don't spend a lot of time.
Okay. My father-in-law went to Olivet.
Wow.
He's told his daughter Diane, my wife, some of that story.
Yeah, I think that's right. They're at Olivet. Who would have thought? But they were caught up in it. The U of M stuff is famous.
Yeah, kind of famous. So you did make reference to those. Those were your Michigan stories. You didn't have any MSU, you said.
Well. Oh, excuse me. In my master's paper, where I just look at the Red Scare at MSU, I look at what else was going on in the state of Michigan, and I mention U of M, Olivet.
In your master's paper.
Yes. There's at least some references to those. It seems like there's at least a couple things said about Wayne, but there was something called the Callahan Committee, which was a legislative committee to investigate communist activities in. You know, in the Michigan universities, in the late 40s, a guy named James Rickney is expelled from MSU. for his communist connections. He was warned to stay away from it, and he invited one of the, I think it was one of the officers of the Communist Party to the People's Church there on Grand River. And I think Hannah sent an undercover guy in and basically said there was Zarechny. Zarechny introduced the guy, et cetera, et cetera. So Zarechny was expelled from MSU for his involvement with communist activities. He had been involved with a group called the American Youth for Democracy, which
was a left-wing or right-wing group?
Left-wing group.
Okay.
And it was considered a communist front group and was banned from MSU.
Okay.
And so because Zarechny was involved with it, he was told you have to avoid all additional political activities. Then when he did whatever at People's Church...
Where did you do research to find that stuff? In the MSU archives or other places?
MSU, mostly, but then whoever I could interview or track down. And that Zarechny guy, I this was 91, this was before the internet. I tried to track him down about 7 or 8 years ago. Someone got a hold of him. The guy, it's a guy's name, Olds. He was an East Lansing writer, maybe not Olds. Maybe I think his dad was mayor here one time.
Okay.
Who actually wrote the one of the MSU history books. You know, there was that three-volume
series.
Right. He got a hold of this Zarechny, if I remember right. So I wish I had spoken to him. But, you know, because it's a fascinating story, getting kicked out of MSU for political activities. But the state news was shut down. I'm sure you know that story.
I forget. Why don't you remind me?
1950, because they had a the American Legion, the Boys State Program, had panels called How to Spot a Communist, or something like that. And the state news said, would have... That's stupid, or whatever else, and they were shut down for.
Is that in your PhD dissertation?
In my master's.
In your master's.
Yep. So
okay.
that was. There were, if I remember right, I looked both at the students and some of what happened with them.
Was this microfiche at the time when you did this research? Or did you go through files of old papers?
Mostly files. And through the Hanna papers and everything I could find there.
The MSU historical collections and archives there?
I certainly went, I did that. I went to U of M for some things.
The Labadie or some other party? Bentley?
The Bentley.
Okay.
I would track down some of these professors. Herb Weisinger, I don't know if that name's familiar. He was then in New York, a guy named Arnold Williams, who was on the English faculty. I had an interview set up with him, and then he died just shortly before I was supposed to meet with him. But he was actually a member of the Communist Party at one point.
And he admitted it.
Yes.
That wasn't something that worried him at the time.
He had left it. I think what happened was when the whole U of M guy, or the U of M professors, when that went down, the guy leading the charge on that was the congressman from East Lansing named Kit Clardy, who was later a member of the John Birch Society. HUAC would send out subcommittees, and Clardy, of course, had an interest in what was going on in the state of Michigan. So he was the guy who led the charge that got those U of M guys thrown out. He came to Lansing, and according to the state news, he met with some MSU professors or he got information about guys with communist ties. And if I remember right, shortly thereafter, there was this Frank Williams, basically admit, I was a communist. Uh-huh. I was young, et cetera, et cetera. And Hannah he had said I would not allow a communist on the faculty. But if you come clean and denounce it, you know, we'll let bygones be bygones. So
he didn't really care, but he couldn't take the bad publicity.
Hannah?
Yeah. Is that what?
I don't know. You know, there was a...
Or did it bother him?
I my guess is he probably wouldn't have allowed a communist on the faculty. And but neither would have a lot of other schools. I mean, for someone who was said, I am a member of the Communist Party, you know, in the 1950s, I don't know that you could do that at a public university, very easily, at least.
And what would have been the belief that they had that person, by saying that they were a member of the Communist Party, that they were unacceptable? It certainly wouldn't be the kind of level of Lash's support of the underdog or that kind of thing. It must be the...
Well, I think there was two things. One, you basically were shutting off your mind to the truth. In other words, it's not that you can't come, people are going to come to different conclusions on things, but as a member of the Communist Party, your loyalty first and foremost is to your party's doctrine.
Which is the whole major fight within the labor movement on the left side, on
right.
The CIO side, the Ruther versus communist kind of argumentation.
Exactly. I mean, my guess is that it's, you could say, I'm a Marxist, but have nothing to do with the Communist Party.
Mm-hmm.
That probably would have given you a lot more latitude than I belong to the party, because I think by the time the 1950s rolled around, there was an increasing amount of evidence, and of course now, many years later, now that we've gone have additional information, the Communist Party was largely, I mean, loyalty to the Communist Party meant loyalty to the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union did, in large degree, control the American Communist Party. And, those were... Can that exist with academic freedom? And, those are all still... Pendulum swung, but I... came across all kinds of articles that was the question. You know, can academic freedom exist with communists,
right,
in their midst? Because they're not for academic freedom. They want to shut it down,
So, the democratic socialist leanings of some key CIO people and on campus people like a Bob Ripas or others would have had a lot of trouble, and they'd be very anti-communist because of that.
It's well, and of course, I mean that's the thing. The if you look at the Cold War, especially in Europe, but to some extent in the U.S., it's not the Republicans versus the communists that's the story.
Mm-hmm.
It's various parts of the left, whether it's the socialists or whatever else, is your primary bulwark against communists in a number of areas, in cultural areas, perhaps academic areas, et cetera.
Now, did Lash get involved in any of this in terms of your sense of him about bridges? And
no, although Lash was a member of the Communist Party at one point, the Communist Youth League back in the 30s.
Which isn't party membership, it's a...
Yeah.
But it's related, obviously.
It's related.
One of many.
But, you know, he would have... He certainly didn't consider himself a communist in any way.
But many people thought Bridges was, and so...
Oh, yes, and Lash did. Lash thought he was a communist, and that he took direction from... You know, whatever the Communist Party line was, he was doing it that he was a communist, an adherent to.
Which might have been Foster at times, might have been Dennis. I mean,
right.
Different people at different years that Bridges would have had relations to.
Before I forget, in '92, I spoke with Bob Ripas, because Lash suggested that I do. He didn't like Hannah in the least.
Ripas.
And was quite certain that Hannah. When I told him about said, look, because part of Now, again, I wrote this when I was 23 or whatever it was. But my point was that Hannah, maybe it was largely out of protecting the institution, but on the whole, he did a pretty good job of maintaining civil liberties at MSU and basically protecting the faculty and, mm-hmm. you know, at a very difficult mm-hmm. time.
Did you ever talk to Hannah?
No.
Never.
He,
okay.
he died shortly before I okay. started this up. And, you know, I said no faculty members were fired for their communist past or communist activities. I mean, you had people... you know, Anthony Koo, if you remember
right.
him, he was denounced as a, you know, like as a communist by someone. Even though his uncle was Wellington Koo, the Taiwanese ambassador. You know, I mean, obviously all kinds of accusations thrown around. There was a guy who Hannah sent a PhD, a guy with this, Herb Weisinger, who was a prominent English professor.
Yeah.
Later moved to SUNY New York, brought with him Jim Harrison,
okay.
the grad who then went on to, and this Weisinger, while at grad school at U of M, was with another guy, and so Weisinger's career takes off. I mean, he's an all-star here, and he goes to SUNY Stony Brook uh-huh. to start things
here. Time here?
Not for another 25 minutes.
Okay.
And this disgruntled PhD student, you know, he's living at a YMCA. In New York, his life didn't work out. So but he denounces Weisinger, said he's a member of the Communist Party. So Hannah sends Art Brandstatter, the former, Jim Brandstatter, of course,
right.
you've heard of. His dad was the head of the MSU campus police.
Right.
And
Jim becomes a U of M.
Right. Right. There's like Art Jr., who's MSU, and Jim, who's U of M.
Right.
Dad was a All-American football player at MSU, then right. head of the DPS. So Hannah dispatches him as kind of his FBI guy almost to
uh-huh.
interview him about this Weisinger and this because he's saying he was a member of the Communist Party, this, that, and uh-huh. the other thing. And Weisinger never even knew that this guy had made... the charges, you know, or that. On the whole, Hannah okay. seemed to do a good job of protecting these guys, and I mentioned that to Rebus, and he said, "No way, Hannah." He said, "You're looking at it wrong. There's all kinds of guys who didn't get tenure."
Rebus is saying this to you.
Yes, because of their political convictions, and he mentioned some guy in ATL. Whose name I don't know or won't remember, but he, Reba saw Hannah as a bad guy and uh-huh. a guy who wasn't protective of civil liberties, but as an enemy of civil liberties. That was my only experience with Reba.
Bob was active with ACLU. He was active with American Friends Service Committee, which is what he did in the war and then came out of the war. And he was one of the first hires into this LIR Center under a guy whose name we haven't mentioned, Alfred Haler. So there was Killingsworth running this new center. Actually, he did research. Hannah asked him to see, should we create something? And there were a couple other universities already doing some labor extension work for unions, okay, non-credit teaching of labor leaders, somewhat analogous to what MSU was doing for business and agriculture, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And Hannah had Killingsworth go out and look at other few other places that were doing something. And when they decided, they did a little bit, then they decided to create a center. And they had Killingsworth as the first director, and this guy Jack Stieber coming from Harvard, who had been with the Steelworkers Research Director, probably after his PhD in econ. Comes here to direct the research operation, And that guy Fred Haler is hired to run the labor outreach, labor program service. Repus becomes one of his first hires, along with Jackie Brophy.
Okay.
I don't know.
Jack Brophy. All these guys, Stieber, Brophy.
Jackie Brophy's a lady.
Oh, okay. I just remember Brophy. I remember well, Lash mentioning all these names.
Right. Well, Brophy.
Stieber especially.
Yeah, well, it would make sense. But you didn't really have much interactions with any of those
Mm-mm.
folks.
No.
Did you have, you mentioned Gus Scholl. Lash didn't have any relationships with labor people himself much, did he?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Or he never mentioned it.
Okay.
And as a matter of fact, the only times, I mean, in Michigan, that is, he didn't. Of course, he spent God knows how much time with the Longshoremen's Union out west, and to some extent in the east, I think when he was a PhD student, he was looking at the New York waterfront.
Yeah, and he also has a little tiny book that, again, I didn't bring it along, called Maritime Labor Relations.
Right.
Which is about the Great Lakes.
Yes.
Which was helpful to me in working on some of these Michigan labor history things. But before Bridges, there's a Hiring Hall book.
Shape Up and Hiring Hall or something
right.
like that, yes.
Not too many people know about that. But, I mean, to me, Lash LaRue was quite a good institution. I say institutional because in the late 60s through the 70s, there's this big kind of internal dispute within the labor history field, as there isn't all a history. You probably got into it in your program.
Oh, yeah.
Between institutional and so-called social or from the bottom up mm-hmm. or that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So these older LIR guys, to the extent they're doing history stuff, are seen very much as institutionalist by the Young Turks.
It's that's always the way it goes, right? The new guys think the old guys are. When I was at Georgetown, I had the antitrust, very prominent antitrust guy. And I said, oh, you know, I said, I never had him, but certainly a guy at Michigan State has quite a reputation, Walter Adams. And the guy goes, guy is a dinosaur.
Just so did you have any, Adams is on my list to ask, did you have any interactions with Walter or,
just,
or Lash telling you about him? Or?
Well, Lash talked about him all the time. They were very, obviously, very close friends.
Now, Lash never smoked cigars with him, did he?
No.
I never saw Lash
nope.
smoke.
Nope.
But
Lash
I never
didn't.
Was around Walter that he didn't.
I interviewed Walter twice, once for my, well, yes, I talked to him two times to go through, you know, who might this guy be? You know, here's a letter written in, or MSU doing an investigation on someone. He's from the econ department. He went here and did this. And, you know, Adams, oh, that's Jacob Schmuckler in the econ department. He was this and, you know, so he, I mean, since he had been here, Lash didn't come to 56. So he was aware of a lot of stuff, but couldn't testify to it firsthand.
Mm-hmm.
Walter came in 47. So he filled in a lot of gaps.
Mm-hmm.
I talked to... well, a number of these guys that were still alive. I think, and I should say, what I
is it all footnoted in your master's thesis?
Yeah, oh yeah. Anyone I spoke with, yeah.
Okay.
Sadly, in 1993, I was at Lash's house, and one of his longtime friends came over, a guy named Harold Reinholds, who he had as a grad student in the 60s. And I was in the kitchen. Lash was in the living room, and he said, and I saw someone opening the back door, and I was about ready to grab a knife, and someone's breaking in. And it was Reinholds. And I said, hey, Harold, what brings you here? He said, bad news, Lash's son, Peter, killed himself. So I thought right then, you know, okay, I'll let Harold break the news. And so then I drove home. First thing I did is picked up the phone and called the Adams, just to, you know, long friend. It just, they should know. And so I think Walter and his wife came over and...
Came over to Lashes.
Lashes. And so Lash wrote me a thank you note and said, hey, that's very thoughtful. Or,
did you know Peter at all?
I didn't. I just, Lash is very proud of the guy. And,
yeah, me neither. I never had met him. I mean,
yeah, he had been police officer after MSU and then, after high school and went back to MSU much later, four-pointed it, went to law school and then, but Lash had, his ex-wife committed suicide, said to Peter, I have one obligation, to stay alive till you turn 18. Committed suicide on his 18th birthday. It's
unbelievable.
Sad. And by the way, Lash had tremendous guilt about her. I'm sure he was sad about his son, but he never really talked about it or expressed it. But I could tell I think he thought, his wife, for example, she had already enrolled in law school at the University of Utah when he took the job here. So she gave that up and moved here. Then, all right, let's have a kid, and didn't end up having this family life because, as Lash will admit, he couldn't help himself. It was, oh, there's a protest on X, let me be involved, and I think that, he thinks that helped drive his wife into a downward cycle. So
I'm actually pretty close to done on questions for you. I mean, you have many more stories. Did you have in your research enter from Lash any stories about the SDS chapter at MSU?
No.
Okay.
And of course, you've read the book about it, about campus wars, about the SDS at MSU.
Mm-hmm.
I'm assuming.
No.
You know which one I'm talking about,
yes,
right?
Yes, but read it. No, but yes.
Okay.
So that's your knowledge of it. What's in the book, pretty much?
Yes, I mean he talked a
you
little bit.
You did read it, obviously.
Yes.
Okay.
He did talk a little bit. Just a couple names, couple people, but not
Beth Shapiro.
Not much. I don't remember. She was she the one who got in legal trouble?
She's a librarian who passed away not too long ago. Well, within my lifetime here.
Yes, I do remember Lash talking about her. I want to say Adams talked about her because she screamed at Adams or denounced him when she was at SDS.
Yeah.
So there would have been a couple of these people, but SDS had a meeting at MSU in 1968, and Lash talked about that a little bit, but just not much.
I only knew about it because I was at U of M.
You remember the meeting?
As an undergrad. Well, I didn't go to it, but... So, like, Madison was here. Actually, there was three here. U of M had one called Residential College, and I was an undergrad there. And a number of the students, I was in the second class, a number of the students in the first and second year, some in the RC, but some just using it as a kind of a place to meet, were SDS activists. So I knew some of that, and I knew that some of them had relations or whatever to MSU students, and then later read some about it. Rick Kibbe was another person here on campus.
Yeah, I certainly remember that name.
Yeah, and then he got involved doing east side of Lansing things, and actually worked for me for a while, one of my projects. So
he died, but Mike Price.
Uh-huh.
Lash would often, he talked quite a bit about him. Wasn't he involved in SDS or involved in a lot of the anti-war activities here?
Yeah. And again, I wasn't here. I was at U of M, but it's related to each other and so on and so forth. And to what relations, if any, did Lash have with Zoltan Ferentz? We didn't talk about him at all.
I think he and Lash were Lash didn't talk a ton about them. They used to, I got the idea they were closer. I know Zoltan was over at his house one time when that Brandstatter stopped by.
Everybody stopped by Lance's,
yeah,
didn't they?
Exactly.
It's funny. We never, I don't think I ever ran into you in those years, but
yeah, everyone was popping by his house.
Yeah.
And it turns out Zoltan Ferenczi and this Art Brandstatter were both Hungarians from the same neighborhood in Detroit.
No
so,
way.
Yeah. So they would, you know, it's like, hey, going back. What do you want from the butcher shop? I want the, you know, so. But he talked a little bit about him.
Uh-huh.
And I know the only thing I've really heard him say is, you know, he thought that Ferenczi embarrassed himself.
By running for office and losing?
With some of these kind of fringe groups. I mean, it's one thing if you're the chair of the Democratic Party and you, this and that, but then...
The Human Rights Party.
I'm going to be this one and this one and this one and get on the ballot. And I'm.
Is that what we're talking about? The Human Rights
Party?
Yeah,
and I can't remember exactly what the details are, but I thought he was like, come on, you know, this is, what are you doing here? Not, you know.
This guy Rivas was friends with both.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was kind of interesting too. And I don't know. I haven't listened to the Rivas interviews in a long time. I did it several times with Bob. I got to be close with him. And I got to go back and listen to him because I wonder what he had to say with both of them. I didn't say anything before. I mean, you can have me turn off the tape here. It may be too close to current. If you knew anything either about the 2012 interactions of MSU... or the other labor centers with the Mackinac Center in their FOIA request?
I don't know anything about it.
Or last year, the 2014 story that had a little bit of similarity to the 1961 story where some state Republicans in the current legislature, I don't know if they ever had any hearings or just talked about their not being happy with MSU's school labor, and probably by that point, School of Human Resources and Labor Relations program in the Building Trades Academy. And it made the papers.
Nope, I don't. You know, and part of it is, and those things are so, I mean, just the way the Constitution is, and the legislature ultimately can exert so little control that.
You're in the executive branch, so
yeah. But I certainly worked in the legislature for several years, and
that was long ago, not during this time.
No, not during that time.
Yeah.
But it's also these things kind of come and go. You know, like these some representative Axel hear about this and then hold, you know, and it'll make the headlines, and then it by and large dies away. I mean,
that's my sense.
All they can do is say, really, MSU, instead of giving you $350 million, we're going to give you $340 million. Because we're mad at about this, and that has its own set of problems.
This was what I considered a rather modest threat, mm-hmm. quite frankly. Kind of similar to what you were saying, and I don't even think there was a hearing. I think it was just a couple reps said so and so, and maybe one of them even was somebody who was term limited as a rep and was going to run for state senate and was afraid that a Tea Party challenger would out-conservatize
him. Yeah, I mean, you know, you never know what the agenda is for these guys, so.
And so you what I'm saying makes sense. That's the way it works.
Yep.
Yeah. I really think we covered tons and I had a great time. Were there FGO stories, though, things about the MSU grievance procedure and Lash being the FGO or if anything ever told you about it? Because that's another project I'm working on down the road.
Just, I remember very little about the specifics, but just about some of the things he did, or the people he would deal with, some of his relations with the presidents, or you know, the administration on some of these issues. I mean, he thought, and he's probably right, that I remember when I first met him, within 5 or 6 weeks at some point, you know, because I think I was a college junior and I didn't fully grasp these these issues. to me, it's you had the students, and then you had the faculty administration.
Mm-hmm.
That's what it was in high school, I thought.
Right.
You know? Well, little did I know that not only is that not the case in high school, you know, everyone, mm-hmm. different unions and different, but it is especially not the case in college. And I remember him telling me, no, the faculty and the administration have two completely different set of mm-hmm. agendas. And so he often would tell me of cases where the administration seemed to be, for whatever reason, you know, giving someone a hard time.
Mm-hmm.
But he also would say, listen, a lot of these guys who I would deal with, again, he goes, I'm a bleeding heart. I can't help myself. I take up their case. But they were, you know, they were a complete pain in the ass. Or you know, the faculty was probably right, or the administration was probably right.
Yeah.
The biggest one that he handled after he was FGO was the Williams case. I don't know if you remember in the 90s.
I do. Yeah.
Go ahead. That he spent, good Lord, a lot of time on that with Williams.
And you knew about that.
Yes. And of course, there's a guy at the Mac who gave me the report done by an outside counsel, basically looking at what MSU did and how they completely screwed that thing up. And it was a guy, he's one of the retiring from the science faculty. I mean, he considers that a big black guy for MSU. But I know Lash was active on that. I don't know if I want to or have her. I'm saying that facetiously. You can record it. I know he did stuff with Dorothy McMeekin at one point or another.
Because she had a suit against the university.
Yeah.
During the did he ever talk to you about the attempted faculty unionization?
No.
Okay. And she was involved with that.
Okay.
And it came at that time. I can't find the one. One of his columns talked about being, it's not a column. It's an academic article he read, and I put it in my file of FGO stuff, where he writes being, I'm the new FGO.
Okay.
I'll share it with you sometime. You get a kick out of him.
So, I just know that he was, I guess, the first one, if I understand it correctly. Wasn't he the first FGO in the 76?
No, because it goes back to the early 70s.
Okay. But at least he did it in the 70s, and then
he came back when somebody left.
At the tail end.
Yeah. Well, not the tail end, but later. He was FGO in the mid-80s, late 80s.
Yeah, right. I think the 88, or 1989.
Yeah, right, exactly. Right.
And then he's by... You remember, well, he was, as part of his settlement...
He's acting that time.
Yes, and as part of his settlement from his lawsuit against the university for mandatory retirement, he would retire in X amount of years.
Mm-hmm.
So he would retire in 1989, and so he did the FGO thing in the winter, I believe the winter and spring of 89, and then was done.
And so I interacted with him then because I served either as counsel or presiding officer for a case or two during Lash's second time when he's acting FGO.
Okay.
Not his first time, which is in the late 70s.
Okay.
So, anyways, this has been great fun.
Yeah. If anything else I can do, let me know.
Not with Lash, but in your other research, did you ever come across references to the Labor Legionnaires, the CIO, or the Communist Party?
Let's see. So, Labor...
1930s.
Just the march, you know, but other than that...
Okay. Something I've never finished. I was going to give you that if you want to look at the videos.
Yeah, thank you.
Something that I did in grad school, UMass Amherst. I was very lucky to have a guy named Bruce Laurie. I don't know if you'd ever run across his name, but he was. You ever run across the journal Labor History?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so he was on the editorial board of that for quite a while, I think. So I had him for a couple of classes at UMass Amherst, and one of the papers, and I ran across it recently, I wrote for Bruce, was on the Labor Legionnaires, and that was a kind of a CP-oriented the CP, well, the American Legion had gotten into big battles over the IWW and the end of World War One kind of business. Mm-hmm. Okay, and so there's some big hoo-has between the Legion and some labor people. And so by the mid-30s and to the late-30s, when we're going to get, looks like we're going to go to war, some of the union people start thinking, what are we going to do at the end of the war? Because we have a lot of people that are union people, but into the war kind of thing. And the American Legion, its reputation is very anti-labor. So Walter Reuther and some of those folks in the CIO end up working in certain directions about what to do with kind of veterans groups. And some of the CP type, with the boring from within business, create a labor legionnaires.
Okay.
And I went to the BOPS library at Tamman Institute in New York City, and then did some, like, kind of things you're talking about, writing to people who were involved. Somebody was in Chicago. I unfortunately never got there, but I never published it, but I turned it into a paper, and I've run across it. And it's
okay.
Like, I've never seen anybody publish it, so I might try to resurrect it when I get done with other things. But I didn't know when you mentioned all the things you've run across. So thanks a lot.
Absolutely.
This is great.